This is Nightmare in Wisconsin.
The trial of Taylor Shabusiness. Accusations of first-degree intentional homicide, strangulation, mutilation, dismemberment, and necrophilia.
We bring you raw, unfiltered courtroom audio from the trial of Taylor Shabusiness. Nightmare in Wisconsin.
Your Honor, I talked to the defense expert, Dr. Litton, had an extended conversation with her last evening, and this morning after we took our break. I need 1 minute. Your Honor, after much thought and discussion with Dr. Litton and with my client agrees with this, that we're not going to call her in rebuttal. We're going to leave the record as it is.
Okay, then, unless I'm mistaken, I'm going to excuse her.
Yes, she can be excused.
Mr. Frelick?
Yes, she can be there.
Any reason, Mr. Lizay, why I wouldn't excuse Dr. Litton?
No.
Dr. Litton, you are excused. Thank you very much for your time. Okay, then I will turn to the state for an argument, Mr. Lizay.
Thank you, Your Honor. As the court is aware, it is the state's burden at this juncture to demonstrate by the greater weight of credible evidence, so it is a relatively low burden, but it is the state's burden to demonstrate that Ms. Shabusiness is competent to proceed in this matter. I think when the court considers the totality of all the information before it, that it's quite clear that Ms. Shabusiness is in fact competent to proceed in this case. And this is a judicial decision. It's not a medical decision. It's a decision that the court can make based on a variety of different factors. We've now had 5 different competency evaluations in this case. Dr. Litton's evaluation is frankly the only evaluation that suggests that she's not competent. I think there are a number of flaws with Dr. Litton's evaluation, and I think that Dr. Seipel's report and his testimony here today call into question a number of her findings and certainly the methodology that was used today. And I do just want to take a moment that when I asked the question about Mr. Frelick being present, I certainly was not intending to suggest that Mr. Frelick did anything inappropriate at all. That was not the purpose of my question. I think to the extent that Dr. Litton had someone else in the room, that's a decision she made that may not be consistent with best practice, but I don't want to suggest that Mr. Frelick made any attempt to try to influence competency. I do think that what clearly makes the most sense is Dr. Seipel's ultimate conclusion in this case, which is that to the extent that there are any potential symptoms of psychosis in this case, that those symptoms had generally been driven by 2 things. Intentional use of illicit substances, particularly methamphetamine, and then volitional conduct, frankly, on the part of Ms. Shabusiness. And of course, as the court is to consider, it isn't just does she have a mental illness, does she potentially have some sort of symptoms that may in some way make it more difficult or more challenging for her to participate. The issue is, do those symptoms, if they exist, do they substantially impact her ability to understand what's going on and to assist in her defense? And I think quite clearly neither of those things are present. Frankly, I'm not sure that even the motion from counsel suggests that there has been a significant impact in his ability to work with Ms. Shabusiness on this case as a result of any of those perceived symptoms. And in the interviews that she's had with all of the clinicians, she appears to generally understand the concepts, the legal concepts. She knows who her attorneys are, what the role is. She knows what the state's role is. She knows what the court's role is. She understands what she's facing, why she's here. And she is able to pretty substantially describe the facts that put her in this position. And the court is able to consider all of the facts and circumstances that are available in its own observations of the defendant at counsel table, of her ability to sit through lengthy, complex motion hearings without disruption and apparently to assist her attorney throughout that process, and Mr. Frelick's ability to communicate with her quite well. It does appear that she and Mr. Frelick have developed a quality working relationship and that she's able to assist him in this process. I think when the court evaluates all of those factors, that it's quite clear that the state has met the burden by the greater weight of credible evidence that Ms. Shabusiness is competent to proceed in this action.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Frelick.
Thank you, Your Honor. The law, Wisconsin law, 971.14, subsection 3 of the Wisconsin statutes indicates that no person who lacks substantial mental capacity or understanding of the procedures to assist in her own defense may be tried, convicted, or sentenced for the commission of an offense so long as the incapacity endures. We have a young lady here, Taylor Denise Shabusiness, who does have mental health problems. She's been at Bellin Psychiatric Center for mental health treatment. They said that she had bipolar disorder with psychotic features. She's been to the Nicolet Psychiatric Center for a commitment, six-month commitment order. She was there for about a month, but she was under a court order for commitment that was filed April 1st of 2021, and that she was deemed to be mentally ill. She was deemed by the court to be adjudicated as a mental defective or committed to a mental institution. She was at the mental health institution, and that she was under a court order to take psychotropic medications. So she has a history here of lots of problems. The Brown County jail records bore out that she's had problems with following directions, standing for head count, drawing on the walls, doing all kinds of bizarre and odd behaviors. And what we have here are two diabolically opposed conclusions or opinions from the psychologist here. Dr. Seipel feels that Taylor Shabusiness is competent, and our doctor, Dr. Leighton, who has a lot of experience, she opines or concludes that she's not competent. So we have a problem here. We have we're at a crossroads. We've got some issues that have to be sorted out. I beg to differ with Dr. Seipel. I mean, he testified that this is not a complex case. It sure is a complex case. There's lots of records. There's lots of history here of mental health problems, drug addiction issues, all different kinds of problems. I think that both of the doctors have a lot of information, have a lot of training. They've looked at all these reports that have been submitted to the court. But Dr. Tracy Lucetta, who's also a PhD, she sent in a report that was filed on May 6th of 2022 when my predecessor, Attorney Jolly, was on the case. And she indicated that she recommended that my client be transferred to one of the state's psychiatric facilities like the Mendota Mental Health Institute or Winnebago Mental Health Institute for further evaluation under close and extended observation by qualified professionals. If she was sent to a state facility like that for a week or a month or whatever time is needed, a whole team of professionals could fully assess my client's competency to proceed in this case. There are all kinds of issues here that have to be sorted out. It's not a clear-cut case, in our opinion. And I would argue that, you know, a 90-minute interview by Dr. Seipel with Ms. Shabusiness, I don't think that is going to be able to be enough time to really fully understand and address the issues in this particular case. You know, Dr. Seipel didn't do the MMPI or the MCMI. Dr. Leighton did not. Dr. Engine apparently did. I also want to comment on the issue with Dr. Leighton. She asked me to sit in, and I know that there were concerns because the chair was thrown at her, and she's an older lady, and so I sat in. And that's what happened there. I I didn't get involved. I stayed out of it. But I was just there for, I think my client felt more comfortable with that. So I just want to comment on that. But I believe that my client is not a very good historian. I think she's got memory deficits. We've got all these records that I've pored over and looked at, sent to the court. I think that my client has had or does suffer from bipolar 1 disorder based on my review of the records. And, you know, based on her conduct with regards to throwing a chair at the professional that's trying to evaluate her, attacking her, Mr. Jolly, allegedly previously in court, engaging in other courtroom antics, the staple going into her arm, not taking medications, you know, who knows? Who knows if these, if the drugs, the methamphetamine, the marijuana, the cocaine, all these other drugs, did they cause brain damage? Did they cause a mental defect? That's all for the court to decide, but I submit that it likely did. And it's caused a lot of different problems for Ms. Chavizas with being able to really participate, understand what's going on, assist in her own defense. The fact that she apparently did have some hallucinations in the past, I think all that leads to the conclusion and my argument that my client should be deemed not competent at this time, or if the court doesn't feel they can even make a decision on that, send her over to Mendota or Winnebago for a further evaluation. Then we'll know. Then we'll know for sure if she's ready to participate in a trial and assist with defense counsel and be able to understand what's going on. I have some serious reservations on her mental status, especially in light of the civil commitment, especially in light of the order to take medications. She has been deemed mentally ill by a court of law, so nobody can dispute that. I would submit that that's likely continuing, but there's all kinds of different opinions here. So I'd ask that the court go along with my arguments that she be transferred to one of the state's facilities for further and extended observation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frelick. Well, I've had an opportunity now to listen to the testimony of both of the evaluators. I've also had an opportunity to review both of their reports. I've had an opportunity to observe and weigh their credibility as they've been testifying and observe their testimony. And you know, frankly, as has been alluded to here by the parties, I've had an opportunity just from the time that we've been in court over the recent past to observe Ms. Chavizas and how she's participated in this case. And on several occasions in the past when we've addressed this issue, I've had I've reviewed the history, and I'm not going to review the history of the competency process that's gone through here in this case again, because I've done it several times. I want to highlight a few things, and that is that on three separate occasions, this court has ordered, has tasked the Wisconsin Forensic Unit with assessing Ms. Chavizas' competency. And I know there's been other evaluations that have been conducted as well, but in the first one, Dr. Collins cautioned the court to maintain vigilance on this issue throughout the case, and I have done that. I have done that, and I've listened to the request for, on various occasions, to have more competency evaluations conducted. On a few of those occasions, I've denied that request, and then this time, I granted it because Dr. Leighton came forward. Really, each of these evaluators has a different opinion. Dr. Leighton's opinion on page 2 of her report is, quote, "My opinion also is that to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty, Ms. Chavizas is not competent to proceed to trial," close quote. Dr. Seipel, as he testified here today, has an opinion directly to the contrary. His report indicates, quote, "The weight of the credible information again points to the conclusion that Mr. Business is competent to proceed, and I offer that opinion to a reasonable degree of professional certainty to the courts for the court's adjudication. Close quote. In analyzing not only their testimony but the reports, I parsed through the reports, and frankly, it's actually difficult to parse out and unwrap Dr. Leighton's report regarding which piece relates to the NGI and which piece relates to the competency. Some things I want to just address regarding Dr. Seipel's report that I find meaningful, that I find insightful to me. I'm going to read a couple of those things. On page 14 of a report, he addresses his interaction with Ms. Shabusiness, and I think it's very relevant. He says, quote, her commentary occasionally waxed somewhat provocative, for example, sexual or otherwise graphic. However, such comments were not directed at me in any form of threatening or solicitous manner. Rather, she simply seemed to be fishing for a reaction. Thus, I either ignored such comments or matter-of-factly acknowledged them before continuing with my line of questioning. Through such an approach, I was easily able to sustain Mr. Business in rational, reciprocal, forward-moving discussion. Her replies were almost always relevant, albeit not always forthright, and she was easily redirected and responsive to prompting when needed. Moreover, in the few moments where she was evidently confused by questions, she easily benefited from simple accommodations such as repetition and rephrasing. Her expressed thoughts were consistently organized. I detected no credible delusional beliefs, finding claims such as that she believed Dr. Leighton to have stuck her tongue out at her to be entirely lacking in credence. I found that relevant. It was a direct reflection of what the doctor experienced when he was interacting with Ms. Shabusiness. In another portion of his report, he notes, in any event, there was no evidence whatsoever of Ms. Shabusiness being distracted by any form of hallucinatory phenomenon. That's on page 15 of his report. Just summing some of the highlights that were also gleaned during the testimony. Page 16 of his report, he notes that Ms. Shabusiness indicated that she can assist her attorney in her defense by giving him all the information possible. Thus, she offered that it is important to be forthcoming with defense counsel. So he's able to help me. He can't if I don't be honest. Indeed, she stated that she has been honest with Attorney Frelick about the circumstances of this case. The report goes on in another location to indicate, quote, when considered in that light, there simply is no reasonable basis on which to conclude that Ms. Shabusiness lacks capacity to behave appropriately and communicate rationally, given that she has now twice clearly displayed such capacities. He goes on to indicate, quote, she has no difficulty grasping the roles of relevant courtroom personnel and the adversarial nature of the criminal proceedings. Again, I found all of those to be very insightful and credible. They seemed very credible. I've weighed the credibility of each of the experts regarding this topic of competency, and I find those observations to be credible from Dr. Seipel. I've observed Ms. Shabusiness interacting with her attorney. Obviously, I can't hear what they're talking about, but as I sit up here, I can see everything that goes on in the courtroom. I can see them interacting, discussing. Ms. Shabusiness indicates she thinks she can work with him. She understands what the courtroom procedures and players are. There's been occasions of inappropriate behavior, which Dr. Seipel indicated on testimony here, that he was fundamentally unable to rule out that they are volitional in nature. I'm satisfied, based upon all the evidence I've received, that the greater weight of the credible evidence in this case, and my assessment of the credibility is included in that the greater weight of the credible evidence supports a finding that Ms. Shabusiness is competent to proceed to trial, and I'm going to make that finding now. So that's the decision of the court. Then regarding the competency hearing, that piece of this case is now concluded for today. The jury selection is scheduled to begin at 1 o'clock. I believe the jury was requested to report at 12:30, so they should be ready to go when all of us are sitting at council table. at 1 o'clock up in Branch 1. And I want to just cover a few topics before we break. I alluded to this before, but I'm confirming it for the parties now. I'm going to seat 4 alternates in this case. That's a lot of alternates, but I don't want to run into troubles for the sake of not having enough alternates. So we're going to have 4 alternates, that means, in light of the type of case this is, and in light of the fact that attorneys get one more strike for every alternate, that each side would be getting 10 strikes.
Judge, I think the statute requires one more strike if the court is going to have alternates. I don't think it has to be per alternate.
Okay. Then I'll confirm that before we start upstairs. We've got the chairs set up for the appropriate number of jurors. The other question I have is, have the attorneys addressed the video as far as redaction? The video was very lengthy. A lot of it had really nothing going on. Mr. Saunders requested that I just simply watch the part of the interview, and he submitted the time frames. Mr. Fralick requested that I watch the entirety of the video. I guess the question is, has that issue been addressed or not? Mr. Saunders?
This morning I was finishing getting a redacted copy, not only the dead portions, but also the portions that were moved and essentially stipulated out. I can provide that. I would hope that's completed now, and I can provide those times to counsel that were excised.
Just answer your phone or shut it off. I'm going to monitor that rule as we go forward. Everybody needs to make sure when you walk in the courtroom, I've entered an order that there's going to be no cell phones functioning while we're in here, with a couple of exceptions that are in the order that I published. Make sure you got your phones off, okay? Back to you, Mr. Fralick. So I guess I don't want to run into a situation where we're addressing an issue of, I got the times from Mr. Saunders, and I don't agree with them. Because I want to know if you don't agree with them ahead of time so that we can address it. Mr. Fralick.
Well, what I think I could do is maybe meet with Mr. Saunders and Mr. Lassay and then talk about it, see it, and then make a decision on that. But I got to see it first.
All right. Good. That's what I'm trying to prompt, because we'll have that video wouldn't be offered into evidence until sometime next week. So you'll have the whole weekend to talk that through, but I want to make sure that conversation is going on so I don't have a jury sitting waiting while we work through those issues. I did, just for the party's own edification, and I think the attorneys were aware of it because my JA contacted your office, I drafted orders based upon the motions in limine that were filed, just outlining what was granted and what was denied so that it's all clear for everyone and we don't have to spin our memory back to what happened. I would invite you all to look at those over the weekend to make sure that they're accurate. I've pored over them. I think they're accurate. So I invite you to do that. But then back to the jury selection. Mr. Lassay, your suggestion is that just simply one extra strike because we're having alternates, as opposed to one extra strike per alternate?
I think so. It's 972.03 is the statute that talks about peremptory challenges, and it says in a case of this nature that everyone gets 6 challenges, and then the language specifically says each side shall be allowed one additional peremptory challenge if additional jurors are to be selected under 972.04 sub 1, which I think is the alternates.
Mr. Fralick, do you have any opinion on that?
That makes sense, Your Honor.
Okay. It's a lot easier if you stipulate, and that sounds like what I've got. So I'll review that section of the statute as well, just to make sure we're ready. And if that's the case, obviously, jurors we pull up changes. So anything else before we break? Mr. Saunders?
Judge, there was an issue that's related to, I think, the NGI evaluation. I think when the court ordered Dr. Engen to perform the NGI evaluation. The court provided access to the competency reports of the other parties, including the prior competency reports of counsel. I would ask that the state be allowed to provide, or that the court provide, to Dr. Engen, as the court-appointed expert on NGI, the new reports of Dr. Litton and Dr. Seipel.
Mr. Frelick, any objection to that?
No, Your Honor, that's pretty common practice.
I think it's fair that everybody that's going to be testifying regarding that issue be allowed to access the reports, so I will order that. I guess the other issue, actually, that is out there is the situation with Dr. O'Donnell. So let's take that up. Mr. Frelick.
Your Honor, I did, the defense did retain Dr. James O'Donnell from Illinois, toxicologist and pharmacologist. He did testify at the motion hearing that we had on the issues and the substances that my client had been using or abusing in the past. I thought his testimony was helpful, and I feel it's relevant as it relates to the NGI issue. I know that the court said that I was to let the court know by a certain date on whether I wanted to have him testify, which I believe was for the trial. And I know the law, voluntary intoxication is not a defense, so I wasn't intending on having him testify at the trial. But if the case gets to a point where we have phase two, the NGI phase, I would like to have permission to have him testify. I provided notice in June, I believe, with his curriculum vitae and a summary of his opinion. We now have his testimony. That's been filed. That's all part of the record. So I would like to have permission to call him as a defense witness if it gets to the NGI phase of this trial. I would not call him during the fact-finding phase of the trial, but I may have had a misunderstanding as far as what the court was asking of me. But as to the trial, I had no intent of calling him at the trial, only at the NGI phase. Thank you.
Well, I guess the issue, I'm going to turn to the state in a minute. You know, as far as the timing goes, I've been very conscious of the timing of how things go to make sure this trial stays on time. And I printed a copy of the transcript from the hearing that we held on June 13. And near the end of that, I noted that I think we've addressed all the motions that were set on today other than the state's motion to exclude the testimony of Dr. O'Donnell. The state doesn't want him to testify. I go on to say, so I think what we need to do regarding that motion is, Mr. Frelick, you need to make a determination rather promptly of whether you intend to utilize his testimony. If he indicates to you, I don't intend to use them, then your motion is really not relevant anymore. A Daubert motion wouldn't be relevant. But you need to make that determination, Mr. Frelick, and then notify the court and notify Mr. Saunders so we can get that on, if need be, and have it heard promptly. So I'm trying to think of a deadline that would be appropriate. And I'm thinking if I gave you a week, you could assess whether or not this was a piece of information that you want to use at the trial and notify everyone of that fact. Obviously, you need a little more. If you need a little more time, let us know. But I'd like to hear from you by the 20th. And then you responded, "Could I have until either the next Thursday or Friday?" And I gave you till the next Friday at noon. And I indicated, "So I'm not going to give you until the close of business on Friday because we'll lose a weekend of scheduling." And what we have now is the state is objecting. And I don't know if they're asking for a Daubert hearing, but I don't know when I'll hear it. And, you know, as far as the trial is one whole piece. It goes in two phases. But if you're suggesting that Dr. O'Donnell is going to be testifying, they're objecting. And so the court's in a little bit of a bind because the jury's coming in two hours. But Mr. Saunders...
Yeah, so obviously there's the issue of the Daubert hearing. I guess the state's concerns are twofold. First, if we're calling Dr. O'Donnell strictly for the confines of what he's previously testified to at the motion hearing on the 13th, not only is it, in the state's belief, not relevant for the first phase, it wouldn't be relevant for the second phase either, because a voluntarily ingested substance is not a mental disease or defect. So if we're looking at the confines of the prior testimony, I don't believe there's anything relevant to the second phase either that Dr. O'Donnell could testify to. If there's things counsel wants to explore, and I don't think it's clear from the notice or the summary we received that there are additional areas to explore, we would have concerns then about Dr. O'Donnell's ability to testify and provide relevant information that he's qualified to offer if we're going beyond the scope of that prior testimony. So those are the state's concerns and why we asked to exclude Dr. O'Donnell.
Your Honor, I believe it was June, quite some time ago, I provided a very detailed notice of intent to present expert testimony. I put the state on notice. I filed it. It was quite thick with the CV and a summary opinion and all of that. We had the motion hearing. I mean, the state, the prosecutors had a chance to ask all the questions that they wanted to Dr. O'Donnell. They have the transcript. I'm sure they've read it. I've read it. It's in the record. I mean, in fairness to me, I would argue we don't need a Daubert hearing. We already had it. We already kind of had it. But the other thing is, with Dr. Christina Engine, I wasn't the lawyer at the time. I don't know if she testified. I've had no chance to do a Daubert hearing on her. I've had no chance to question and cross-examine her about her report and findings. And so I'm at a disadvantage. We're all should be on a level playing field. And I know the court said that, but in my opinion, I thought you were talking about the trial. I was always thinking about the NGI phase of this case. And that's where the relevancy, in my humble opinion, that's where the relevant testimony would come in with Dr. O'Donnell. The other thing is, Your Honor, was the funding. I mean, I got the funding for him to come here and provide testimony with regards to the motion hearing. But I had to get permission for funding for any future hearings. And, you know, experts are extremely expensive, and they've got to take basically reorganize their calendar. But I did get additional funding for Dr. O'Donnell to come for the NGI phase of the trial, if it even gets to that point. But I understand the court is kind of in a difficult spot, but I mean, we all kind of know what he's going to say and what he would opine about and the information that he would provide. And I think it is relevant and helpful to the court because, you know, maybe the drugs caused a mental disease or defect. I don't know. That's for the professionals to talk about. But you would think that a toxicologist or a pharmacologist would have some relevant information on that particular topic. So that's why I'd like to call him as a witness.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'll indicate that I don't think I've ever denied anybody a Daubert hearing on any expert witness in this case. So if somebody wanted a Daubert hearing and they didn't get one, it was because they didn't ask for one.
I was just told, Your Honor, about Dr. Engine.
Pardon?
I was just told about Dr. Engine, like maybe a couple days ago.
The second thing is that the question, I think, is really, it's straightforward. If it isn't permissible to offer an opinion that as a result of voluntarily ingested drugs, wasn't able to form intent, if that's not the issue, because I think the attorneys and have rightly analyzed the current state of the law in Wisconsin, is that's not a defense. Voluntary intoxication is not a defense that's permissible to be put on. If that's not the issue, then what is the issue that's going to be presented? And I think the concern that the state has is the testimony that was provided last time relates to the issue that isn't permissible as a defense, that is voluntary intoxication. Therefore, if Dr. O'Donnell is going to testify as to something else, something that is permissible, what is it? And is he qualified to give that opinion? So I guess that's the situation that the court is left with. But I'm also cognizant of the fact that Daubert hearings occur in very different fashions. Sometimes you bring the doctor in and testify. Sometimes the court takes a look at what they intend to testify to and what their qualifications are. So what I'm going to do is I'm not going to rule on that issue just now. We'll take it up again. But I'm concerned, quite frankly, that if what the testimony is going to be, assuming we get to the responsibility phase, is that these drugs were ingested, and a result of that decision to voluntarily ingest drugs, there's an issue regarding responsibility. I'm concerned that that's not going to be relevant, and that if I afford the opportunity for the doctor to testify, as soon as he gets done providing his qualifications and the questions start, I'm going to get relevancy objections. And that those may very well have to be sustained other than, you know, come on, just let us present this, doctor. So I think I'm going to ask you, Mr. Frelick, you need to reformulate what you're... I want to be clear to you, Mr. Frelick. I'm not going to deny Dr. O'Donnell's ability to testify based upon a timing issue.
Okay.
So we had the hearing on June 13. That's not the issue. I related that simply because I want everybody to know that I want this to move along and I want to avoid inconveniencing not only the parties but the jury. And if there needs to be a Daubert hearing, I've got to figure out when I'm going to get it done before the jury trial starts. And I'm going to start the jury trial on Monday morning. So I simply related that for that issue. So moving on from that, I'm not going to use that as some reason to deny the testimony. If the testimony doesn't come in, it'll be for some other reason. And the reason that I'm concerned about, Mr. Frelick, that you need to address and I think perhaps discuss with Mr. Saunders is, what is this doctor going to testify to that's actually relevant and that's permissible under Wisconsin law? Because, again, I'm concerned that if we just leave the record the way it is and say he's going to come in and repeat what he testified to on June 13, that I may likely conclude that that doesn't come in. But I'm not making that decision right now. I'm letting everybody digest those comments for a little bit, and we'll take it up at a different time.
Thank you.
Anything else before we break? Mr. Saunders?
No.
Mr. Frelick?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
I'd like the attorneys there a little bit before 1. I intend to get the jury upstairs as close to 1 as I can. If you could be there about 10 minutes to 1 so we can address any remaining issues. I will take up, I will review that issue that Mr. Lizet raised, but it sounds like we have a stipulation that each side will get one additional strike due to the fact that we're sitting 4 alternates. That means everybody gets 7 strikes. That's your understanding, Mr. Saunders?
It is.
Mr. Frelick?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good. And with that, we are concluded for now. We'll see you at...
You're listening to True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast continuous coverage of the trial of Taylor Shabusiness, Nightmare in Wisconsin.
Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage.
More raw trial audio next.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.